Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Reverend Don Lewis coming to you from witchschool.com. Are you looking for the best in pagan and magical education? With more than 12,000 pages, witchschool.com is like having your own personal library with individual learning assistants to help you study. And Witchschool's Anyone, Anytime, Anywhere education system is available any place on Earth, anywhere you are and anytime you want it, as long as you have an internet connection. Witchschool's lifetime memberships are a great value. They really do last a lifetime. They've been there for years, and they'll be there for years to come. So get your membership today at witchschool.com.
You're listening to Pagans Tonight. Pagans unite on Pagans Tonight. Many paths, one network. For over 5 years, we've been the place to connect with the best, brightest, and most trusted voices in the pagan world. Every night is Pagans Tonight.
Thank you for tuning in to Walking the Unnamed Path. My name is Matthew Sidney, and unfortunately, Michael Greywolf is not able to join us this episode, but he will be back soon. Sitting in for him, we have fellow Unnamed Path initiate, Tommy Starchild. Tommy, say hello.
Hello, everybody.
And I want to thank all of our listeners for tuning in. We have something very special scheduled today. We're going to be chatting with Karina Blackheart, the author of A Witch's Book of Silence, an initiate and teacher of the Anderson Ferry tradition of witchcraft, as well as the Edge Witch Apprenticeship and other courses. But before we bring Karina on, Tommy, I just wanted to touch base and ask you, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Resting up, or at least trying, from the in-person this weekend. Didn't have as full of a week at the shop as I had hoped, but that goes either way. It means I get a little bit more rest, but recuperating work-wise is also needed. But the energies have remained intense since the weekend.
Yeah, it was a beautiful weekend. And for the benefit of our listeners, this weekend we had an in-person, those who undertake the Unnamed Path Apprenticeship, which can be done remotely. There is a mandatory in-person at about the six-month mark. And I am participating in this class as a student teacher. And so this past weekend was the in-person for that class. So we had students and several of the brothers came down. And how many people? We must have had, 17 people total in the house?
Something like that. Yeah, the numbers seem to have fluctuated anywhere between, I think, 14 and 17. I'm not sure. That might have been because locals coming in and out. But I think there was 14 or 16 all staying at the house.
Yeah, somewhere. I think there are, the most people we had present at any given time was maybe 18 people, but not all of those were sleeping over.
Right.
And I have to give kudos to you, Tommy, because you initiated the weekend with a magnificent workshop.
Thank you.
On which, I don't know what you could call it, you touched on the dampers of the blue flame and how that ties into shadow work, which is one of the key elements of the path.
Right. The name of that workshop, I call it Pulling Spirit, because it's about connecting with your own spirit, your own root, or what I refer to as authentic self, and some self-diagnostic tools, as well as various techniques to see where you shift out of alignment with your spirit, how to shift out of alignment from your true self, and how to get back into alignment, which of course deeply involves the shadow work, because it's aspects from our shadow self that influence and feed the ego self or our lesser self that keep us in the perception that our true self is that ego self, as opposed to the true spirit that resides within.
Yeah, it was impactful. It was an impactful weekend. I don't know what else I can say. Let's go ahead and bring on our guest, Karina. You are live on Walking the Unnamed Path. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here today.
So, you know, one of the reasons we really wanted to have you come on the show is because your book, A Witch's Book of Silence, has become a huge hit within the Unnamed Path community. As a matter of fact, one of our teachers has added that to the syllabus, the required reading for his students. And if you don't mind, I'd like to read a little passage from the book to give our listeners a taste of what's in this material. Let's see. This is from the section called Leaky Cauldron, Loose Lips Sink Ships, which is something I often say. And, quote, when we share our personal experiences with others, two things happen. First, the charge of power built up through having and holding the energy of experience is diffused. Have you ever been so excited about something you felt that you would burst if you didn't tell someone? That feeling of being about to burst is the charge of power. We use speech as a means to relieve the pressure of a built-up charge. However, this is counterintuitive to what we are attempting to do in the craft, which is to build power. Rather than diffusing it through idle speech, we contain it past the point when we think we might burst. We hold onto that charge. Share it with the God soul. Integrate it. Become big with it. End quote.
So, first of all, you know, it's really nice to hear someone else's voice reading my words. So let me just say that. I don't think I've ever heard anyone else read my words back to me out loud. So that was really beautiful. That was really powerful for me. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And, yeah, you know, you mentioned that someone in the Unnamed Path is using the book for as required reading, and I do really know a handful of teachers who are assigning the book as mandatory reading in training, and that just it's a beautiful thing, because I think this in the age of information that we live in, you know, we tend to share everything as soon as it happens. That's what Facebook is for. That's what Twitter is for, right? Oh, I'm at this restaurant. I'm eating this food. I'm meeting this person. Our whole lives are sort of curated and on display. More so, you know, than way back in the day before we had these devices in our hands where we could report on every little thing happening in our world. The power of holding our space, you know, holding our experience, is so important, you know, to the witch, but to everybody, you know, to everyone, to be able to sort of say, this belongs to me. This isn't for public consumption, right? That there are some things that should be private, that should be held close to the chest, as my teacher would have said, hold it close to the chest.
Yeah, it's true. And I think it's an especially important message. You know, as you mentioned, you know, in this today's day and age, I think there's a lot of oversharing going on. And even I myself am guilty of that. And I think your book is timely because it's a good reminder to all of us that we, you know, the best way to obtain validation isn't necessarily to, you know, post everything and, you know, and so, from every some people, every time they move an object on their altar, they have to post a picture of it. And, you know, sometimes that's beautiful and wonderful, but, you know, I can't help but wonder, well, is that really necessary? Is that really the best way to maintain that connection with spirit?
Right. Well, as you say on page 14, to speak of magic and power diminishes it. And I was thinking as you guys were talking about folks that do take pictures of their working altar as they're working, or take pictures of their spell workings and things and post those and say what they're doing. That's one of those curiosities for me, because it taps what should be taking place in my opinion beyond the veil. And when you dip into that and bring it to this side and then post it on the internet, you've taken power out of it. And you've also introduced how you do things to the viewer.
Well, you've also invited the gaze of whoever is, you know, scrolling down their Facebook or their Twitter or their Instagram feed, right? There's something about the gaze that is, you know, the Italians called it the evil eye, right? Malocchio.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're doing a working and you're putting it out there and someone is looking at your image and they're like, well, why do they do that way, right? Or who do they think they are? Or even, why is that picture on the internet? You've now introduced a stream of negative energy into your magic. Right?
Right.
You've invited the world, really, to have some kind of response to the working that you're doing.
Right.
And for me, I want my working to be my working, right? I can't control for how everyone on the internet is feeling in my magic.
Yes.
Right? So
yes.
I don't put it out there on the internet. I put very little about my personal practice out
right.
there for the world to see, because it's the more you put out there, the more you're inviting. And for some folks, they have a good sort of rapport in the online communities. I tend to be a little more defensive, I guess. And
right.
I think my magic. Is a bit defensive, right? Like, I don't want to, we don't want to be inviting people's negative judgments, really. Putting
right.
something on the internet, you're putting it out there for judgment. Either you're going to like it or you're not.
Exactly.
Or now you can be surprised or grateful or whatever. But you're asking for people's judgment. You're asking for people's affirmation. And that's great if you get a lot of affirmation, but we don't really measure for the folks who are not affirming. And that negative energy impacts the veracity of our magical work, our spell work.
Yep.
My teacher used to say to me you know, even when he was teaching me, there would be things that you could see that it was painful for him to tell me, right? He really was struggling with this. Am I going to share this intimate thing with my student, right? And he said it was like sharing the intimate details of his sex life, right? And that was just with me, right? His student, and we were trying very hard to develop a relationship of perfect love and perfect trust, right? So, you know, do we put the details of our intimate lives out there for the world to view, right? There's a certain kind of, I want to say it's a lack of self-respect or, you know, to play the game of show and tell all the time. Now I'm going to get in trouble, but.
I was just thinking that's really rich.
Yeah, and do you think maybe part of it is that people are looking for attention, they're looking for acceptance, and the sharing or oversharing is a way of reaching out, albeit probably not the best way, but do you think that's a component?
I absolutely think it's a component. Look, I'm putting the word community in air quotes, right? That is we're spread out over tremendous distances. We have people living in areas where there's nobody, right? I mean, I just moved from an area where there was nobody like me just to, like, go and have tea with, right? That's really a painful place to be. And I'm a long-time practitioner. So I imagine the person who is newer, right, and who grew up with social media, right, that is a way of trying to connect with other people. And I don't think that there's anything wrong with seeking to connect with people. I don't think there's anything wrong with looking for love and friendship and connectivity. I think that it's a symptom, though, of the larger culture that we live in, where people are so lonely. You know, we're so lonely, and yet we're sitting in front of screens, right? And we really need to get out and talk to our neighbors. We really need to get out and go to things where we see people face to face, as hard as that is.
Yes.
You know? That is part of the breakdown of our culture at large. It's part of the reason why, even as we are all sitting home in our cubicles, right, in our nuclear households, watching this horror show unfold in front of us. I mean, I keep wanting to, like, jump up and run out into the street and join the masses of people in the street, but there are no masses of people in the street.
Hmm.
You know, and I feel like, you know, we're all waiting for someone to organize us. Anyways, I'm way off topic, but it has to do with isolation, you know, with the feelings of feeling isolated and wanting to be seen, you know. It's very hard to be seen when all we do is go to our 8-hour job or a 15-hour job and come home and sit in front of a screen.
It's one of the ironies of our age that we're so connected. We have these tools that make it easier than ever to be connected, and yet at the same time, we too often allow these tools to separate us, and we use them to cocoon ourselves. And like you said, you know, box ourselves into these cubicles. You know, whether it be at home or at work, and you know, so we're trying to connect digitally, but we crave something more meaningful.
Yes, and you can only, you know, you only share what you want people to know, right?
Yes.
So, you know, if you want to take, you know, let's go back to the picture of the altar. You know, you can take a picture of a beautiful altar, but if you know, but your life might be going to shit, right? May be having, you know, a really hard time in your relationships or financially or emotionally, but you can build a pretty altar, you know. And so part of the weirdness of social networking is the curating, right, the curating the images of how we want to be seen, right, as opposed to this is what's really going on. right?
It's true.
Yeah. I mean, magic is messy. My altar never looks like those pictures. My altar is like, it's got like candle stubs and incense ash and, you know, I mean, I clean it once a week because that's what I do, but it's a mess because I'm actually doing stuff at it, you know? Magic is messy. Life is messy.
It's very messy.
Yeah, well, it's like, you know, someone who's a real cook in the kitchen, their apron's always going to be dirty.
Right, and your floor is sticky.
Yes.
How do you know that?
Because I'm a cook.
Now I know what I'm going to do when this show is over. I'm going to be rubbing.
I'm going to go home and clean our houses.
This brings me to a part in your book that I found fascinating that you dove into is what you have titled A Cultural History of Privacy. As you kind of dig into where we were and how we got here.
Yeah, it, you know, that's all my own opinion, by the way.
Sure.
You'll notice that there aren't footnotes to, you know, me quoting research. But, you know, my parents came from, I'm 50-something, and my parents were two generations older than me, so they were born in the 1920s. And so I grew up with a sensibility of parents who came of age during the Depression. My father was in the Navy and during World War II. There was as bizarre as it is how much we share about our lives now, it seems to me that there was an equally detrimental ideas about privacy, right, and not telling anything to anyone outside the house,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So in my household, often there were words like, that's none of our business, right, if you're talking about neighbors, or
right.
what will the neighbors think? That was actually something said in my household very, very often, as though the neighbors could tell what was going on in our house. But we didn't talk about, you know, my parents didn't talk about things like how much money they made. And this was cultural. This wasn't just my
right.
parents. This was an age. They didn't talk about how much money they made. They didn't talk about how much money they had. They didn't talk about how much money they paid for their house or car. They didn't talk about, outside of the household anyway, issues that they were concerned about their kids. And this is really the epitome, right, of the nuclear household, you know, as it
right.
came into being, and you know, that we would look at as sort of 1950s, early 60s nuclear family. I just happen to have parents who never let that go.
Yeah. I think as you mentioned, there's not footnotes in your book, but these are the observations of a witch. And we often, in this era of accessible knowledge, we tend to put more emphasis on what can be supported by research and less emphasis on the observation of the witch.
It's true. I originally, when I was writing the book, I had a lot more quotes from, you know, the Andersons themselves and my teachers and other witches, you know, who are well known in the pagan community. And I slowly but surely took most of them out because I thought my voice stands on its own, right? I don't need to quote Thorne Coyle to back up what I'm saying. What I'm saying has veracity in and of itself, right? I don't need to quote the Andersons to back up what I'm saying, even though they're very, you know, incredibly wise elders, ancestors. But to be able to trust our own gnosis, right, to say what I know is what I know. And it comes from, yes, the observation, the careful and meticulous and obsessive observation of the witch, right? And I happen to observe people and cultures, you know. Other people observe animals, you know. Other people observe herbs, you know, what grows in the woods, what can you eat. So we all have our special, you know, our specialty areas, whether we recognize them or not. But I'm a bit of an anthropologist, you know, even though that's not what my degree is in.
Yeah, I think one of the things I treasured the most about your book was you speaking from experience. And one of the things that resonated strongly with me was you touch on how silence creates a space, like a vessel, in which the power can be gathered, where you can feel it when we stop focusing on the chatter. You know, we're able to use more of our senses to feel that energy. And you put into words what I had learned over the past year. And it took me after, you know, many, many, many years, because I've been very spiritual my whole life, but really last year when I went through the Unnamed Path Apprenticeship was when I learned the value of just sitting and being that container and allowing it to be filled with these forces all around. And then I read your book, I'm like, yes, yes, someone gets it, and she expressed it so beautifully.
Thank you. Yeah. You know, we are the vessel. You know, we're the chalice. I mean, we are the everything, right? The witch is her altar. The witch is his chalice. The witch is their blade. The witch is the fire. I mean, we are the microcosm, right? And so to be our own cauldron, you know, of transformation. Is extraordinarily powerful, you know. But again, you have to learn to keep the lid on the cauldron, right? So that your own delicious, savory flavors, you know, come to the fore, and that you cook things slowly and with a lid. That holds in all of the flavors. And again, you know, when we take the lid off of that cauldron, right, if we're going to continue the metaphor of cooking, when you take the lid off of a pan, off of a pot on the stove, all the steam comes out the top, right? And that steam is part of what's helping the ingredients cook, right? And that's that bit that you originally spoke about of that discomfort of sitting with, you know, our excitement about our magic, right? Our, you know, that moment when you're like, oh my God, it really worked. Right? When we're first, you know, I was going to say when we're first learning magic, but, you know, I still have those moments. I'm like, that worked. It really worked. You know, and I hope that I never lose that astonishment, right? Because I think that that's part of it. But when we disperse the steam, right, the head of steam that builds up under the cauldron, that is our silence. When we let the lid off and we want to chatter about things, we really are dispersing part of our magic, you know.
Karina, was there a moment? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, Tommy.
Go ahead.
Was there a moment when you realized that this was the book that you needed to write? Was there something that triggered the motivation?
You know, I'm going to be perfectly honest and say I usually write because I'm pissed off and I have some. I usually write because I'm like, why aren't people getting this, right? And so you don't know how many drafts of that book I wrote. And how many times I said, that's really too harsh, you have to take that out. That's too harsh, you have to take that out. And I finally just like said, you know, that's my voice. That's my voice. My voice is a bit harsh. I'm opinionated. And I'm almost a crone now, so I can say it if I want to, and I don't care. so, you know, I wrote the book, I think, because I had students coming to me for training, and they'd be like, well, I read about such and such on the internet, and when are you going to teach me that, right? Mm-hmm. Or so-and-so is writing about such and such on the internet, and how long do I have to wait till I learn that?
Mm-hmm.
And the other side of that, and this actually happened again just recently. Someone came to me for training, they said, well, you know, but I'm also training with this person, that person, that person, and that person. And I thought, well, why do you need me in that mix as well? Like, isn't that enough?
Right.
How many teachers do you need at a time, right? How much are you actually absorbing and integrating if you have four teachers? That's
right.
A lot.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot. You know, reading four books at once is a different thing than having four teachers at once. But anyways, you know, I had that was sort of a red flag, and then I saw a post on social media that, you know, said, oh, here's what I learned today, blah, 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 and it was like a bulleted list from whatever they got in training that day, and I thought, that's exactly why I wrote my book.
Yeah.
Because what I saw there was, and this isn't even about that individual. So if that individual is listening and you know I'm talking about you, it's really not about you. You're the current example. The inability to hold that information, right, and recognize that magic is not information. Magic
Can
is
you say
power.
That again?
Magic is not information.
We're going to make a T-shirt.
Thank you.
With that on it.
You can gather all the information about the craft that you can possibly gather. You know, you have bookshelves and bookshelves or websites and websites. Information is just information. Until you actually do something with it, right? Until you actually use it, until you actually dare, right? That's the other piece of this pyramid, right? If you're going to gather knowledge, but knowledge is just knowledge unless you do something with it.
True.
Very true.
You know, if you dare to do magic, then something else happens. And guess what? You can't write about it on Facebook. Because it's in the mystery now, right? I mean, magic is mystery. It has to be experienced.
Yes.
So
right.
we have, you know, before we started the interview, Tommy and I were chatting a little bit about, you know, writing books and particular publishing houses, you know, sort of contracting. That if, yes, we'll publish your book, but then we want you to write X number of books over the next however many years, and you really begin your writing to fulfill a contract with a publisher rather than writing because this is the passion that you have in your heart that you want to share with people. And this is why you have, you know, the other thing that we were saying is there's an awful lot of nuts and bolts books out there, right, the how-to and the how to start practicing witchcraft, right? The nuts and bolts of the craft or paganism. And I laughed. I said, how many nuts and bolts books do you need? You know?
Exactly.
We can collect dozens of nuts and bolts books, but until you do what's in the book, it's just more information.
Right.
And we live on information overload anyway.
And I think that's what inspires folks. I think that's what inspires folks to keep pursuing other traditions, other practices. The search for information, assuming at some point they'll find that key bit of information or that key practice that will unlock everything that they've been looking for, rather than putting into practice what they've already learned.
So, you know, sometimes people ask, you know, if you could have lunch with, you know, so-and-so, famous people, right, what would you say? And, you know, someone asked me once, if you could have lunch with Oprah Winfrey, what would you say? And I said, I would ask Oprah, why, Oprah? Why? You have had access to some of the best, most brilliant teachers on the planet. And yet you're still running around looking for the next thing that's going to save you.
Yeah.
If you would, and I would say, Oprah, just do what one of the teachers tells you for 2 years.
Yeah.
And you'll have the thing that you're seeking, right? The thing is that it's information overload. You know, it's like you keep pouring things into the cauldron, and the cauldron is overflowing onto the table. When you need to do is get in the cauldron and be still, do the practice. Every one of these nuts and bolts books has instructions in it.
Right.
Do the things. You know, every website on the internet that talks about the craft has some exercises. Do them. You know, do the work, because information does not transform you. It, you know, new information can sort of spark an intellectual revolution in your mind, right? You can like be like, oh my God, my whole world view has changed. Okay, but how does that integrate into your life? You know, there's a difference between theory and practice. Theory just makes us smarter, which is a good thing, right? Being smart is a good thing. But practice introduces us to our own power. And if you're reading 100 books on witchcraft, if you're studying witchcraft, it's because you seek power. Seeking power is not a bad thing. If you know what power is, power isn't control, power isn't authority, power isn't abuse, right? Power is something that comes from within. So sometimes if we have 5 teachers or we're reading 100 books, what we're really looking for is something to ignite the power within us. But that actually requires that we be still, that we do, that we take action. Right? That sounds funny, be still and take action. But I'm saying, like, be still, stop trying to put more things in you, right? When what you're searching for is in you already, right? Charge of the Goddess says, if what you're seeking, you don't find it inside, you're never going to find it without. So at some point, we have to stop putting things in, and we have to let our own sort of glorious divinity bubble to the surface. And that takes time. It takes time.
One of my fairy students observed, because he was new to the craft when I took him on as a fairy student, and he didn't pass that gate easily either. And so he's starting to venture out a little bit more and meeting other people in a broader community sense. And after his first experience, he came back to me. He's like, I finally get why the way you do. He
He's like, I didn't realize other people are seeking an external experience to have an internal change. And you're teaching internal experience to have an external change.
Ugh, beautifully said.
Now, we have a question from the chat room, and Karina, this is for you.
Mm-hmm.
One of our guests asks, do you think one of the reasons people feel like they need all these teachers and books and widgets is because they're just looking for an easy path to some kind of power or authority?
I think that people are seeking, and I think we don't have this is not a well-worn path, right? Even now, you know, you can go online and you can find 1,000 groups, right, to join on Facebook of, you know, witches and shamans and pagans and heathens and radicals and, you know, on and on. But we don't have a lot of role models for this slow process. I have a student who calls what we do slow magic. You know, like the slow food movement, that this is the slow magic movement, right? And for some people,
yeah,
it's, you know, and Blackheart Fairy moves too slow. They're like, oh, I got to go where I'm going to get this faster. I want it faster. I want it now. I blah, 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 blah. I'm ready. And I say, okay, well, you know, I will always wonder what you could have been had you gone slow, right?
Yeah.
There's something to be said about a stew that simmers on the stove for 12 hours as opposed to something you pop in the microwave, right?
Those are the best sauces.
Yeah. People
slow
are
cooked,
seeking
yeah.
nourishment. You know, people are seeking their own soul, their own divinity, their sense of I'm having a hard time finding the words. My heart is like so wide open right now. People are seeking a sense of I belong here on this planet, right? I deserve to be here. I have worth and value, right? And I think that when we go from teacher to system to tradition to guru to path, and that's what people are seeking, right? And again, it's a matter of like, you just have to sit still. Just do any of these, walk any of these paths for a bit of time. And I'm saying 2 years minimum, right? Walk a path for 2 years minimum. People who are in their 20s go, oh my God, 2 years? I'll tell you, you know, I'm 50-something and 2 years is like a heartbeat, right? 2 years
yeah.
you go, well, how can I be that old now? How could I have done that
yeah.
20 years ago? 2 years is nothing when we're talking about eternity. Right? We're talking
yeah.
about touching into the eternal nature of what it means to be a human being, right? The witch is human and wild and divine. And to know that is one thing, but to experience it, you have to slow down. You just have to slow down.
Yeah,
like,
it does. It takes
down,
time.
It
takes time. It also takes a certain amount of humility. One of the highlights for me in your book is the story about the chainsaw, the chainsaw massacre section. And but that really, like this, I mean, this is a story that I'm going to be passing on to, you know, when I'm 80 years old. I'm going to be telling your chainsaw story, you know, to kids, because it gets such an important point across.
Yes, that we can't really teach what we don't have an experience.
Yeah.
You know, we shouldn't teach what we haven't experienced. As teachers, we have a, oh my God, responsibility is immense. The responsibility to teach a spiritual path is immense. It's not
yes.
something we should take lightly. And if you're making up things because they sound like they would be cool or really witchy or really something, right, impressive, and you're exposing people to it and you don't even know what it's going to do, that's really dangerous. To me, it means either you don't really believe that magic is anything, that it does anything, right, or you don't have respect for it or care for the people you're exposing to danger. So in my book, yeah, the story of the chainsaws was, you know, teaching someone a very foundational practice in the fairy tradition, which is the alignment of the threefold spirit, and Kala, which is a rite of purification. And I taught this to someone, and 3 days later, she emailed me and said, I want to teach this to my friend who's in an abusive relationship because I think it will help her. And I said, well, do you know what it does? Well, no, but it's not dangerous. And I said, no, it is dangerous. You don't, aligning your threefold soul, it is dangerous. You know, we're talking about bringing together pieces of ourselves that we don't even know about them.
Right.
Right? We're talking about, when we talk about doing purification, right, you know, we begin to stir the dredges of the cauldron, the dregs, you know, come floating to the surface. And people often, they need to have a teacher. They need someone who has some experience to sort of be like, it's okay that that's happening. It's okay. That's supposed to happen, right? But if you don't know that that's supposed to happen... And giving those tools to someone whose life is already in disruption, to me felt very foolish.
Yes.
And it was interesting because this person and their cadre were sort of like, well, this isn't dangerous. This is spiritual tools. These aren't weapons. They're not drugs.
Well, would you say that the experience of doing witchcraft the old ways, would you say that if it's not dangerous, are you tapping in?
So, you know, I have to quote Victor here and say, Victor said, anything worthwhile is dangerous.
Yes.
Okay? Victor did not say, anything dangerous is worthwhile.
Here,
okay.
Here.
Yes, and you know, I've heard it misquoted that way, you know. So the craft is dangerous. Magic is dangerous. and I'm not saying that to be like, oh, ooga booga, you should be really scared because this is a dark and dangerous path. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that the craft that I teach, anyway, is about excavating that which is within us, which stands in the way of our magnificence.
Yes.
Okay? And so that means all of, like I said, we're just scraping the bottom, the dregs at the bottom of the cauldron, right? We're going to stir up old memories. We're going to stir up trauma. We're going to stir up cultural, you know, damage, abuses that we've been through. You know, this is, you know, though we are not psychologists, right, these concerns that the overculture says, names as psychological, right, they are also spiritual problems, right? So you should see a psychologist if you're in training. I highly recommend it.
Yes.
You know?
I actually did a
lot. to help you with the psychological processes that may be coming up, the things that get unveiled as we do this work. The spiritual training is to clear the spiritual detritus that is co-concurrent with emotional issues, right?
Right.
So that's part of the danger of the craft, right? That's like early getting your foundations in place. And then, you know, there are all kinds of things that, you know, Victor Anderson said, you know, don't do this and make sure you don't do that. And I'm not going to even say what those things are because, and, you know, it turns out in the end of his life when they went and they took apart his, you know, his altars and they went into his home and they, of course, they found evidence of all of these things that he told all of his students, don't do that. Right? But what he was saying was like, I took the hit for you. You don't have to go do that dangerous thing. Right?
Right.
But we're talking about dealing with the unseen realms. We're talking about dealing with spirit. Spirits aren't nice just because they don't have a body. That's a very New Agey Christian idea, right? That just because you don't have, just because you're invisible, means that you're better, right? You're smarter, you're more benevolent, and you won't hurt me. You know, that's
right.
Nonsense.
Well, what's most marketed to the public is this watered down, you know, fat free, extra light version of spiritual traditions and spiritual practices, which really, if people don't have a broader understanding, can get them in trouble. If they, you know, wide-eyed, innocently, you know, stumble into something they're not prepared for.
And those people will never know that what's happening as a result in their lives, they won't make the connection that has anything to do with their spiritual life. They don't. It happens all the time. You know, I went to a festival, there was this amazing ritual, you know, and then a month later they're like, my life is falling apart. And I'm like, do you think one has anything to do with the other? And people are always surprised. That's a question. Like, oh, I never made the connection. You know, because somehow we don't really believe what we're doing is real, right? You know, so on the one hand, yes, this is all really dangerous and yada, yada, yada. And on the other hand, the gods protect us in our innocence, right? I really believe that as well. You know, like when folks pick up advanced books and they want to work with stuff that I think is advanced in my tradition, they want to call on the guardians or something like that. The guardians are kind of like, oh, that's cute. We won't hurt you. We won't hurt you for that, you know?
don't break
you know,
the
place.
That's
not always true. I know folks who, you know, who say, you know, they did that work and they did get hurt.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if you approach with innocence and curiosity, you know, you might be okay. It's like anybody else. The gods are people just like us.
Right.
Yeah.
What I've noticed a lot of is a very human-centric approach to a lot of this work, in that the human individual seems to have the authority, as opposed to realizing that these are living beings, be they spirit, be they gods, be they fae, all of these are living beings. And just because they don't occupy the physical world doesn't mean they're less than.
Right. It doesn't mean that we can boss them around. And it doesn't
exactly.
Also doesn't mean that we should allow ourselves to be bossed around.
Exactly.
Right? So, again, the getting yourself right. Right? Getting your own shit together, right? So that when you are entering into relationship with the fae, gods, guardians, the djinn, the land spirits, mm-hmm. the water spirits, anybody on the astral planes, you know, all of these beings, right? we want to be in relationship with, right? And ideally, we're not entering into the same kind of relationship we had in the Judeo-Christian paradigm, right, where it's a father-child, parent-child, master-slave kind of relationship. Nor do we want to flip that on its head. We want to have a healthy relationship with Spirit.
Right.
Our relationships with Spirit will only be as healthy as our relationships with other people. So if you are abusive in your relationships with other people, you're going to try to be abusive with your relationships with deity, right? You're going to be bossy. And if you are codependent in your relationships with other people, you'll find yourself in codependent relationship with deity, and you'll be like, oh, well,
right.
I have to do everything that this God tells me to do because I'm their special chosen one. And I'm like, oh, there goes another good witch.
Yes,
you know,
or people who
I was going to say, or people who suffer. You know, they have, it's almost like, you know, the abusive parent and, you know, I'm going through this horrible thing, but, you know, it's I'm an awful person and I deserve it. This is why the goddess is putting me through this. And, you know, this, you know, the other side of that, of not really, of diminishing the self rather than awakening to one's nobility.
It's very difficult to be 100% self-responsible. And that is what the craft asks of us.
Yes.
That is not an easy path when there's nobody to load it off on and say, mommy said so, or daddy told me I'm bad, or the gods are making me do this. When we have to say, I am God, as surely as I created the universe in the beginning, I'm God, right? That means I'm freaking responsible.
Right.
That doesn't diminish the fact that we live in a culture and there's oppression and, you know, there are other forces impinging upon our divine nature, right? But not being able to offload our responsibility to a deity is very hard in a culture like ours. Yeah.
Dominic taught me in building relationships with deities and such, it's, you want to woo them like a lover.
Yes.
And I find when I share that now, I guess woo is not a term used much anymore. So I find I have to explain that.
Yes. Yeah, that's the same way that I was taught, of course, Tommy, and the same way that I teach it. You know, what would you do if this was a lover you were interested in knowing, right? Would you go and ask 100 people what they were like, or would you say, let's go to dinner again? I can't wait to learn more about you. Let's stay up and talk all night long.
Right. And
right?
And the difference in commanding the guardians to arrive as opposed to reaching your heart out with a longing as though reaching out to a long-lost lover that has been distant and yet you can feel them draw near is an entirely different experience.
Yeah. They'll come as commanded, but honestly, I would so much rather call upon my beloved than demand someone show up for me. Yeah.
Right. Well, it's like my partners. If I demand of something, you know, I might get it because they recognize the situation. Life in my household worked a lot better if I do so lovingly.
Yes. And I also want to acknowledge that, you know, we're talking very specifically about fairy tradition now, and that there are other trads where the relationship is, you know, it's sort of set up in this familial, like, you know, barter exchange, I'll punish you if you don't give me what you want thing. And believe me, there are deities that I do work with them that way, right?
Mm-hmm.
But not the ones of my tradition.
Right.
Because that's not the relationship we have, right?
Right.
But if I want to go and work with, you know, particular deities of other traditions, and that's the way that they interact with human beings, that I have to be able to do that too, right? When in Rome,
right.
Do what the Romans do.
Yeah. Right.
Well, I think
Karina,
a lot of culture
also influences some of these practices.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, did you ask me a question? Because I heard two voices. So.
Sorry about that. So
okay.
I'm keeping one eye on the clock. I want
yes.
to hear about what you're writing now. Because I know there's
you.
More books.
Yes, I am. I'm working on a couple things currently. One is some work that I've been doing a long time developing, I won't say perfecting, but over a long time in fairy tradition. The way that I was taught fairy trad, that we didn't really do much treatment of the ego. There's the focus is on the threefold spirit. And the dense physical body. And then at some point post-initiation, I ran head-on smack dab into a wall with my own ego, right? And I thought, I don't really have the tools to deal with this from my trad, not the way I was taught it. Not saying other lineages don't. And so I developed a body of work around bringing the ego under the hand of love of the threefold spirit. So that is one piece that I am working on. There are drafts in various stages of development on that. And then I'm also working on writing about development of very localized, very small communities, and not necessarily pagan community, right? I think on the whole, pagan community does a really shitty job of taking care of each other. And to me, community means that we take care of each other.
Hmm.
Community doesn't mean you have one thing in common that you agree on, right? Community means that we take care of one another, and we don't do that. Other religions do a much better job than we do. So I'm not addressing this to pagan community. This is a book about developing very localized, very small, interdependent communities and economies that are interdependent, very localized. In response to what is happening on the global stage, what's happening on the political nightmare that we find ourselves in, and you know, we all can see what's coming, right? So if we can see what's coming, we better get ready, and we better not wait for someone else to tell us what to do. I think we have to begin acting immediately around setting up supports for one another. It's obvious that the government is no longer going to do for us the things that we've become accustomed to the government doing for us, like providing public school systems and some kind of access to health care and. So how are we going to do that? The research and writing that I'm working on, I will say that is much more in research stage than writing, although I do have some essays done. And I am writing essays and sharing some of my work on my Patreon account. Patreon, if the listeners don't know what it is, it's a place where you can become a patron of the arts, right? And you can support monetarily support my ability to carve out time to write with as little as a $3 donation a month, and that gets you access to everything I'm writing on Patreon. And you can donate more than $3, obviously, but that helps me to focus on writing. Really, these days, what I'm doing is I'm teaching the craft and I'm writing, and everything else that I had been doing is off the table. I'm only teaching the craft and writing. So Yes, that. Those are the
and,
books.
And tell us about the Edgewitch apprenticeship.
Oh, so the Edgewitch apprenticeship, I'm going to try to do this really quickly because I know we're like out of time. It will be starting in September. It is not fairy training. Fairy training is very specialized. I probably, you know, I just opened up the gate for more students and had over 90 people apply. I cannot take even a third of those people. So that doesn't mean that, you know, the two-thirds of those people aren't worthy of training. It just means I have to pick the ones that I have the most, whatever. So I would like to have a training for those other folks, right, who really want to work with me in some capacity. So Edgewitch Apprenticeship is that. It is an initiatory path. It is a path that you can then learn to teach and take to your communities. It is very much about living on the edges, right, and taking up space, owning that the witch is an edge walker. That's where we live. We keep trying to create centers, and when you create a center for witches, guess what? The witches all scatter to the edges again, right? And things fall apart. We go, oh, how come we can't hold it together? Because we're not supposed to. I mean, Carrie Pratchett said it best, right? We really just get together because we want to make sure nobody's gone off cackling. So this is a place where witches are encouraged to explore what that edge is, and to explore the edges of the seen reality. So we'll be doing lots of work with divination work and seership and meeting folks who live in the other realms. So this is a bit of a departure from the kind of craft that I have been teaching in the past. I'm really excited about it, really sort of off-the-cuff kinds of divination. Can you divine from looking at the sky right now? What is the sky telling you? What is the wind telling you right now without having a system in front of you?
Mm-hmm.
So edgy, witchy stuff. And that's 13 months starting in September. And if people are interested in learning more about that, right now I'm just collecting names. And email addresses. So send me an email at edgewitchapprenticeship@gmail.com, and I will send you something, you know, within the next weeks. Don't get nervous if you don't hear right back from me. Mostly I'm just gathering people's names now, and I will start getting information out to people in earnest mid-June, okay, for a training that starts in September.
And is this an in-person training?
An in-person training. Nope. We'll be doing this over distance. We'll be doing this using all of the technology available to us. And I am always happy in either the Blackheart training or this Edgewitch training to come to your area and offer the training there if you have enough people for me to come out.
Wonderful.
Yay.
Yes.
Before we start wrapping up, do you have any announcements or anything else you'd like to share with our listeners?
I don't think I do, other than I am out of Florida and I am back on my homeland in New England, and I've only been here less than a week and feel an incredible sense of gratitude and belonging, both to land and the communities here. And, my heart is just broken wide open. Florida taught me a lot about solitude. That's it. That's all I have.
Okay. Well, Karina, thank you for taking the time to chat with us, and thank you for the work that you're doing. I think, there's a lot of ripples that are going out there that I think your work is impacting more people than you probably get to see directly. So that's a good thing. I know I'm grateful. A lot of other folks are grateful mm-hmm. for what you're putting out there. So we're eager for more. So
thank you so much. That means the world. You know, when you put out a book, and you don't go on a tour, it's very hard to know. Like, are people reading this book? but you know, the feedback that I've gotten has been, you know, really 100% positive, and people are using the book the way that I want them to, and that is, they're taking it slow, and they're going back to it and reading it again and again, and that's the kind of book I wanted to write. I want that book to be earmarked and highlighted and just beat the hell out of that book. Use it, you know, keep it by your bedstand and read it again and again, because I really wrote it so that it would be a book that when you pick it up 5 years from now, it's going to still tell you something that you didn't hear before.
Yeah. It's definitely a must-read with a highlighter.
I have two
different colored highlighters and a ballpoint pen.
Yay! And post-it notes.
Exactly.
I know that there are folks out there who are like, oh my God, don't abuse the book. I'm like, you don't love a book unless you have written in it and scribbled in it and folded the pages. That's, at least I don't. You know, I have so much
Catholic guilt about writing in books. I, you know.
So now you have to write in the book as a spiritual practice.
Right? This is part of my journey. That being said, I'd like to close out the show. I'm totally tripping out on the last page of A Witch's Book of Silence.
Mm.
So, and I think our listeners are going to really dig this. To attain these powers, go into the Well of Silence, your pool of reflection. You may find it in the forest, the night sky, the shoreline, your garden, canvas, instrument, or altar. There, spend time with yourself, the spirits, ancestors, and your gods. You will find your pool of reflection always at the edges of things and in the wild places that stir your soul. Sit alongside the babbling brook with a quiet mind and listen to the story it tells of ancient storms, fire, earthquake, glacier, and granite. Be with the plants and ask them to teach you their medicine. Lie down with the four-leggeds that you may exchange understanding. Place your ear to the chest of your beloved so you might memorize the breathing of your heart and the scent of your skin. Be still with your body and listen for its wisdom about your health. Sit with the words and memorize in your training, your practices, your rituals, prayers, and spells. Do not speak of them with others. Refrain from comparing notes or exchanging ideas. Let them tumble through the recesses of your mind, revealing their multi-layered meanings until you have your own certainty. Trust that. Only then listen for the interpretation of others. Let the purity of your prayers arise from that deep well of silence. Let power and mystery reveal themselves to you. Be patient. Sit with your questions and wait for the answers from the unseen. Knowledge is distilled and arises as wisdom from the deep well of silence. The wise speak little. What few words they do say, gather together and string them like pearls. Wear these close to your heart. Like a compass, let them direct your steps along the path. If you would be wise, hold your tongue.
Well, then there's that.
This is, Karina, thank you. This is a precious gift. The world.
Thank you so much for saying so and for having me on your show. It's really lovely to be here and lovely to be with you too, Tommy.
Oh, it's so nice to be at least this close to you.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
All right, guys, you enjoy the rest of your weekend. I love you both. And
until next time, to our listeners all over the sphere, we love you and thank you for tuning in to Walking the Unnamed Path, and practice silence.